The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The group of death comes to life. Wing-backs of Germany assemble. Portugal have no answer for Gosens and Kimmich in a cracking game in Munich. Own goals, counter-attacks as Germany beat Portugal 4-2. Meanwhile, for all the French pressure, quality and chances, it's a massive punt upfield that earns them a point against Hungary in the searing heat in Budapest. What does it all mean? Does Deschamps just want to play England in the last 16? And should we celebrate a full house in Budapest, or is that too simple? And in the late game, Spain are held by Poland. A goal for Lewandowski. Moreno's missed penalty costs Luis Enrique's men. Poland probably deserve it, despite the fun goal-mouth scrambles at the end. As always, we'll answer your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, hello.
Bonsoir, Max.
Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Hello.
And from Munich, for as long as we've got him until TV steal him away, Archie Rintutt in the Allianz Arena. Hello, mate.
Well, Max, well, that is the Fußball Arena München, please.
Ah, I apologise. Now, Archie, I mean, tell us about the atmosphere to begin with. How was it?
Better than the other day. I think Germany fans have a problem generally in supporting their team because they've never really had to push Germany along. They've almost always just turned up, Germany have won, and they get on with their lives. But more recently, they've needed to at least try and push the team. And that wasn't really there the other night against France. The French supporters were much louder than the German ones, even if they were outnumbered quite heavily. But today, I thought that they were really good, and we had a pretty good atmosphere here. And I think that even just hearing the supporters celebrate Robin Gosens' offside goal to begin with, I think that gave the team a little bit of a push in terms of, here's an incentive, you can go and get that now, you can get that feeling. And whilst Germany dropped off in the 15 minutes after they conceded, I thought that this was a surprisingly good performance by them.
I mean, Kimmich and Gosens there, Wilson, were brilliant in this game. And like all the goals came through them.
Yeah, going forward, absolutely exceptional. But I had a strange sense that this told us more about Portugal than it did about Germany. That I think we knew Germany were potentially very, very good going forward, albeit maybe lacking a classic centre-forward. But the concerns of the defending, and I'm not sure any of that sort of went away. Portugal's break for the first goal was an exceptional break. Yeah, Ronaldo covering the length of the pitch in, 14 and a half seconds or whatever it was. But why was Kai Havertz sort of the last man back? What was going on there? How is that part of the organisation? So all the problems we'd seen against France, all the problems we'd seen, you know, even in the Spain game when they lost 6-0 last year, none of them have gone away. But what was amazing was Portugal, you know, this team who all their success is based on their obduracy, turns out they can't cope with wing-backs and the ball being switched very quickly.
All that is true. But before that, Philippe, it was just a really, really fun game of football.
Yes, it was, Max. Much more fun than perhaps I expected it. But I'm with Jonathan on this one. I'm a little bit nonplussed, really, by the lackluster quality of the Portuguese defending. And I'm actually wondering, when you see the team that they finished with, if Santos is going to actually change some of his personnel for that last game, because suddenly, obviously, the whole dynamic of the group has changed. Things could go horribly wrong, which they didn't against Hungary in their first game. They did here, and they might do again against France really, really heavy game, which is expecting that. But it was tremendous fun. I mean, my regret is that Gnabry's volley was cancelled because it's the kind of goal. Honestly, I said it's Gerd Müller, but it's completely Gerd Müller. You need the power, you need the pivot, and spectacular nature of it. It really at time was certainly going forward. This was a kind of Germany that you dream of watching, but that you don't see very often. And I have to say, and I would like to have Archie's word on that, because he's a much greater expert about it than I am, and also Jonathan's, and yours, Max.
Stop it.
I after 15 minutes, I started really following Thomas Müller throughout the game, and it was an absolutely extraordinary exhibition. I've never seen a player who was basically telling every other player where to go, where to run, who to cover. It must be absolutely horrible for his teammates. But it was magnificent. It was magnificent. And actually, he played a role in almost all of the goals just by his movement. It was absolutely terrific.
So just adding to what Philippe is saying there, he has a famous nickname over here, which I think was enhanced by football without fans, and that is Radio Müller. Radio Müller. And that was given to him by his former youth team coach and German football legend, Hermann Gerland, because he was just always so loud and so communicative on the pitch. And that goes back to his youth team days. And you can clearly see, as Philippe has said, you can clearly see before the first goal that before Thomas Müller actually plays the ball out wide, he's pointing over to Robin Gosens being like, make the run, make the run. And he does. And Thomas Müller knows what's going on. He brings a certain authority with him to his team. And I think that this kind of direction, this kind of purpose that he gives them is something that Germany have missed without him.
I think it's strange, Wilson, that some players... You sort of think all these players are training all day, every day. They should all be talking. I mean, I know humans are different and some people do things in different ways. But we heard it a lot in lockdown, like Jordan Henderson never shuts up. But it sort of seems strange to me that it's such a big thing that a player talks. You'd imagine they all would.
I mean, I think it's not, I think if you did have them all talking, I think that'd be massively counterproductive. Because fundamentally, one cook and some sous chefs is what you're after, right? You don't want kind of a team full of head chefs. So I lost faith in that metaphor halfway through.
Well, really, what you want is you want a head chef, sous chefs, pot wash. You want a maitre d'.
Chef de partie.
You want everything, don't you? You know, You've got to have a link between the kitchen and the front of house. You've got to have everything in your team for it to work.
I mean, a restaurant these days is a squad game, isn't it?
Absolutely. I want you to eat some humble pie, Wilson, because somebody sent me a video clip, you look baffled, saying the words, I'm not impressed by Gosens at all.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's true I did say that, and I would I would now amend that to say I'm not impressed by Gosens defensively. Going forward, okay. It turns out he's really good.
Interestingly, Archie, I don't know if you've seen that, you know, the revenge of Robin Gosens, or Gosens, how am I saying?
Robin Gosens.
Gosens. He, in a game in Serie A, he plays for Atalanta, he asked for Ronaldo's shirt after a game. After the final whistle, I went to him, having not even gone public to celebrate, but Ronaldo did not accept. I asked, Cristiano, can I have your shirt? He didn't even look at me, he just said no. I was completely ashamed. I went away and felt small. You know that moment when something embarrassing happens and you look around to see if anyone noticed it? That's what I felt and tried to hide it. I very much hope he went up to Ronaldo and offered him his shirt today and said, I did all right today. I mean, those wing-backs are brilliant, Archie, aren't they?
When it works, yes. Yeah. And I think that you highlight Cristiano Ronaldo. He's an important figure when we look at this game from a tactical point of view of what was the difference between Germany against France and Germany against Portugal. I thought against the ball, Kylian Mbappe made a big difference in the way that he was disrupting Germany's build-up play. He was just road-runnering backwards. And that was really, I think, stopping Germany in creating any momentum. Whereas Ronaldo was doing a bit more Thomas Müllering in the way that he was pointing at others to do some of the work, except the difference is Thomas Müller goes and does that himself as well. And I'm not saying that Cristiano Ronaldo is not a team player, but it's a key difference. It's a key difference in how both games...
I think you can say it, Archie, if you want to.
Heaven forbid.
I think that he still delivers most of the time, but yeah, I think he probably needed to put in a little bit more work today. In terms of those fullbacks as well, just to pick up on another point, Joshua Kimmich picked up a very early yellow card in the last game. And you might be aware that he's from a place called Rottweiler, and that was effectively putting a muzzle over the man from Rottweiler in the first game. And this time you could see that he had a lot more freedom, and some of the ways that he was spraying those balls with both feet. He was talking in the press conference yesterday before the game about how he feels like a bit of a bystander when he's playing out on the right-hand side, and also for him, playing in a back three or back five is at right back is very different, and I think you saw that sometimes in the way he was covering the space defensively. But when Germany hit their stride and when Kimmich and Gosens are allowed to be as dangerous as they were today, then they are a dangerous side. As Jonathan says, though, as much they've been talking about how much they've been working on set pieces, and the fact is they conceded from their own set piece in the first half, and then they conceded that free kick in the second half. So still work to be done, but Max, I really didn't see this coming. Really didn't see this performance coming.
Peter says, how should they present the golden boot to OG? Should they all get in a room and hang their heads and argue as to why they shouldn't get to keep the trophy? Chaz says, with own goals being the surprise breakout star of the tournament, which Premier League club will pay way over the odds for him, and why will it be Everton? Philippe, is there any... Can you put your finger on why they're... I mean, five own goals so far, that's more than ever any other Euros, and we're still only in the group stages. Is there any rationale for that?
I'm sure you could find, by twisting the facts, you could find loads of rationale, but it's pure coincidence, really. The record was three for a whole tournament. Point A, even though it doesn't apply yet, this is the biggest Euro of all time. So obviously the records, we're going to have a look at them a bit differently. But no, I mean, I'm sure you could argue it's got to do with panic in defences, which perhaps are not organised as they should have been. Perhaps we can see consequences maybe of what the year has been for everybody. A bit crazy. Actually, I'd like to give my stat about Bruno Fernandes here, Max, because I'm amazed by that. And it's actually true. Since the 16th of May, 2020, so that's a year and a month and a couple of days, he's played 83 games. 83 games. Now, I think that even the guys who are constantly telling us that in the good old days they were playing Boxing Day, Christmas, every Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, everything. This is quite unique. And I'm actually wondering if there are not quite a few people who are in this situation, and perhaps where you physically... people are not quite as sharp as they should be. Mentally, they might not be as sharp as they should be. And because of that, you've got chaos. But to be honest, this is very much a kind of a result bias kind of analysis. And it's not an analysis at all. It's probably just pure luck.
Wilson?
I mean, the only thought I have, I mean, I think Philippe's probably right. I think it is just a small sample size. I'm trying to think what the five own goals are. So there's the Szczęsny one, which I suspect until fairly recently, that wouldn't have been given as an own goal. That would have been given to Robert Mack, because the ball hit the post, came back, hit the keeper and goes in. Then the two today and the Turkey one against Italy, I can't remember what the other one is, but those three, they're all from wide players getting behind the fullback and driving the ball to the goal. So I don't know if it's because fullbacks are so attacking these days, those spaces are there, and it feels like... the instinct of players when they get in that crossing position these days is to hit the ball low rather than to play it in the air. So maybe that makes them more likely. But that's a very sort of vague theory. I as Philippe says, I suspect it is coincidence. But if it keeps going, then that's my theory and I'll stick with it.
I mean, I'm staring at my wall chart. I can see all these results and I can't remember any goal that has happened in this tournament. I mean, we should mention... one, Portugal's goal was a thing of beauty, right? And we occasionally, I think we set the bar high for Ronaldo, and we can be critical, but he heads the corner away and makes up an amazing amount of ground. Bernardo Silva's passes, everything about it, Philippe, was glorious.
Yeah, well, and the control by Jorge Jota, yeah. I mean, at full whack, and exactly every single movement in this and every single touch was dosed to perfection. And I mean, Ronaldo, I was a little bit surprised. I didn't know he was capable of sprinting that fast, because the idea now is that he's very old and he's become a kind of Pipo Inzaghi. you know, stays in the box, never moves from there. This is, you know, demonstration. He certainly is not that. Absolutely magnificent. But I still don't quite understand. I mean, there are loads of things I don't understand, obviously. But this Portuguese team, I just don't understand it. I mean, they were under the cosh against Hungary. But Hungary are not a bad team, and we're going to talk about that a bit later. They were under the cosh. You wonder, I mean, the team that started has got absolutely nothing with the team that ended the game.
But on paper, they look like a better squad than 2016?
Yes, on paper, if you completely put aside all things such as fitness and fatigue, which are the most important thing, and perhaps in this case, perhaps Santos didn't think about how to counter this German team as well as he should have in terms of organization. And it's a very negative setup, you have to say, with Carvalho and Danilo, who are there. And by the way, Danilo, for me, is better at centre-back, but that's a personal opinion.
Renato Sanchez had one shot. I don't know what it was like in the stadium, Archie, but I mean, it's one of those ones that hit the post and then went back about 200 yards.
Especially, Max, because Renato Sanchez had such a difficult time here when he was playing for Bayern Munich. It felt really weird to see him strike a ball with such confidence in this stadium when I've seen him look so intimidated here. I think that the ooh that came from the crowd after that was a real, if that goes in, these are a very different last 10 minutes. And if you're to say one criticism of Joachim Löw, it would be that his substitutions today actually invited Portugal back into the game. I'm not sure how Robin Gosens was feeling in terms of fitness. He was making even a few runs forward in the first half where he wasn't being spotted. And I think that costs you energy as well. But I thought that Germany were off it for the last half an hour. And I think it shows you that, look, at 4-1, it's a very different game. But still, like, I think just one question mark there about how long he can afford to take Robin Gosens out, because Marcel Halstenberg didn't bring anywhere near the same momentum down that left-hand side.
And sorry, Archie, is there anybody who can play that role on the right who's not Kimmich?
Lucas Klostermann, but he's out injured potentially for the entirety of the tournament. That's not a great sign for Joachim Löw. Emre Can, I would say, has also played in that fullback role, albeit on the left-hand side.
He doesn't have the legs to get up and down, does he, Can?
But yeah, mm-hmm. That would also be my doubt about him. Niklas Süle has played at right back for Bayern this season, but I wouldn't say he's cut the most convincing of figures.
I'm just thinking,
when he's played there,
is there a way of getting Kimmich into the middle to give his sort of tactical nous to the back of that midfield, which I think desperately needs it. But
Matthias Ginter had a spell playing there for Borussia Dortmund under Thomas Tuchel a while back, but I think that Joachim Löw is reluctant to push Kimmich into the centre, even if I think that Germany's best central midfield pairing is Kimmich and Goretzka. They're the ones who complement each other the most. So I can't see him taking out both Gundogan and Kroos for now.
Very nice to see two traditional kits, not a monochrome. You know, it was just a lovely thing to have on my television. Bagpuss says...
And the same in Hungary, France as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Bagpuss says, despite being a thrilling first half of Portugal-Germany, was anyone else distracted by the nonchalant pigeon? Archie, you were.
Always. Always, Max. We've had pigeons before at Borussia Dortmund. This one nearly got in the way of one of Thomas Müller's runs. So, yeah. What worries me, Max, is didn't see the pigeon at all after half-time. I wonder what's happened to
it. Somebody killed a pigeon. How do you see Germany going into the next game, Archie?
Well, as somebody who predicted a 2-1 victory for Portugal coming into this one, I think I have to swing back the other way now. I think that there's a lot more momentum to take into that. They're going to face a side who are likely to sit a bit deeper and be a bit more disciplined than Portugal were today, and Hungary will look at this and think there are still going to be chances. Peter Gulácsi has shown in the Bundesliga on many occasions for RB Leipzig that he is a quality goalkeeper. And I think that it's just going to be about patience. And I don't know whether they'll get the same space that they got out wide today. But let's see. I think it's a far more positive outlook now. There was big pressure on this game, because if they lost today, then they're on the brink of going out. I think that is 3 points going to be enough for a third place team right now? It looks like
maybe for one of them.
Exactly. So the mood has changed, and Robin Gosens is definitely the story here. He is by far the most down to earth of this Germany team, and I think just having somebody who didn't come through one of these famed German academies as well, you can see it in the way that he plays, in his technique, that he doesn't strike the ball like many other players. It's quite unorthodox. But also just the way that he speaks. He was speaking before the tournament about how he knows what it's like to put out job applications after doing his A-levels. He knows what it's like to be working at a petrol station for a fiver for an hour. I think that he's the sort of character that people here are going to warm to. This is his first real stretch in the national team. And if there was to be one big winner out of the tournament so far from a Germany perspective, it's certainly Robin Gosens.
Archie, thanks for your time. Go and do your television.
Thank you, Max.
Archie Rintut there, out in Munich. There was no social distancing in Budapest in that stadium, and we'll talk about that game in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. On Friday, the Guardian's Today in Focus podcast focused on why England's footballers are so determined to keep taking the knee. They did a pod with Paul McInnes and Liam Rossini. You can hear that wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, Today in Focus is a good podcast, but it's not as good as this. So why not vote for us in the British Podcast Awards? You go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Type in Guardian Football Weekly and vote. Thank you. All right. Before we get on to Hungary 1, France 1, Wilson, you've just remembered the other own goal.
Which was Hummels against France, which, I mean, I should have remembered it, but certainly Philippe and Archie should have remembered.
Absolutely
so
right.
We're all a disgrace.
We're already, you know, go
but
somewhere
anyway,
else.
The point is that is like those other three, that it is a ball being driven across the box from somebody who's going behind the fullback. So
I think Barry set the bar yesterday when analysing Sweden Slovakia didn't know the score of the game, so I think we're all okay.
That Sweden Slovakia game, I was working on it, and it might be the worst game of football I've ever watched. It was absolutely dreadful, and I criticised them to such an extent that I'm now headline news in Slovakia. I got called up today by Denik, I think it's called, and they did sort of. They appeared to print like 2,500-word interview with me just saying how bad that game was.
It was terrible. I don't blame anyone for not knowing what happened.
Did they agree, Jonathan, by the way? Did they agree with you, with your judgment?
Well, in the email, they said they did. I don't know. I mean...
well, if you are misquoted in Slovakia, I'm sure we have a listener in Slovakia, so could you check for Jonathan, please? Hungary won, France won then. Simon, was this a cunning plan by the French so that they can play England next? Blaise, I don't think it's Blaise Matuidi, said, is a draw worse for France than it was for England, or is that just recency bias, trademark? Will says, when can we expect the Wilson book on this Hungarian team and their influence on European group of death qualifiers moving forward? Quite a point for Hungary. I mean, France had so many chances. But Wilson, let's begin by praising the Hungarian team.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were a little bit unlucky against Portugal. I thought they defended as well as you realistically can. The goal against Portugal was a deflected pass, then a deflected shot. And then they fell apart as they chased an equaliser. I sort of always think... Well, no, I mean, even Sweden. I was sort of thinking, if you are sitting back trying to absorb pressure, you do have to offer something on the break. And, you can't just sort of resist. You have to, in some way, threaten the opposition. Otherwise, there's no... You don't know what to do with it when you have the ball, and the opposition don't have to worry about you. And Hungary did offer that. I thought Szoboszlai and Salah up front were both very, very good. you couldn't say the goal was deserved, but it wasn't unexpected when Hungary took the lead. And they couldn't quite hang on, but at least this time they didn't collapse having conceded, and they've got a point. And they can now go to Germany, and of course the great cloud over Hungarian football history is the 1954 World Cup final. Das Wunder von Bern, when they threw away a 2-goal lead to lose to West Germany. So now this is a perfect chance of revenge, where they can pull off Das Wunder von München. München.
Is there anywhere we could learn more about that?
Yes, there is. There's a very good book. I forget who wrote it, but the the Names Heard Long Ago came out a couple of years ago. It's had some excellent reviews.
Excellent. Look that up if you'd like to read another of Wilson's books, or one of Wilson's books. I don't want to presume. The goal from Fiola was, I thought, was a really good finish. When you're on the run at pace, to actually control that finish was good. And I don't know about you, Philippe, it felt slightly reassuring to see Hugo Lloris looking miffed. I feel like I saw that like three times a week during lockdown, and to not see it in the first game, you know, made me hark for those days where all that was happening on my TV was Burnley, Crystal Palace, or Lloris looking disappointed with a collection of centre-backs.
Yeah, you've missed the miffing.
Yes, I have missed being miffed. I mean, France, Philippe, in the first half was superb, I thought, and Mbappe was a total delight.
Yes, the first half performance was truly excellent. All that was missing was goals. Three really clear-cut chances. I'm not absolutely sure that it's the kind of French team that you should have sent out against Hungary. I'm not sure that the selection was completely right, but there you go. But on the other hand, they looked, as they did against Germany, completely in control of it, thinking, you know, whatever happens, we'll do the job, and that's that. And there were some inspiring moments. Mbappe was actually better than he had been against Germany, where I thought he'd failed in a lot of things that he had attempted. This was not the case. He was really terrifying today. And there was, again, signs that the Mbappé, Griezmann, Benzema triangle can work, and very nicely indeed. You could see N'Golo Kanté going, you know, on the right-hand side, on the right wing, going a bit forward, and Paul Pogba, you know, taking it on from where he had left against Germany. But then it was not as utterly convincing. And you start, it's the problem with these first group games. You never quite know, as you haven't got a precise idea or a good idea of the level of that particular team on that particular day, and you're making conclusions, taking conclusions which are honestly a little bit precipitated, hurried. But they got back into the game. To be honest, I think Hungary, despite what they offered, can consider themselves perhaps a little bit lucky, but not undeserving of that draw. Now that France Portugal game, the revenge of 2016, is going to be absolutely monstrous.
Is it? I mean, it could be. But
yes.
You don't think there's a chance they might just go, you know what, a draw takes us both through?
And then who plays England? Max would know.
Well, that's presuming that England beat the Czech Republic, which I'm not presuming. So you're playing at your... You will know. They will know by the time they get to the game. They will know what they need to do or not do.
Well, assuming Germany do beat Hungary.
Yes.
Yep.
And that's also, don't forget that the third best place, if it qualifies indeed, would probably have to face Belgium. Not exactly a good idea.
Oh, right. I mean, I'm because of the third place playoffs, I'm just waiting until the last 16 is on a piece of paper in front of me before I start.
Yeah.
Trying to work out the combinations. The interesting thing about the French goal was, after, you know, they played some lovely football at times, but their goal was absolute Sunday league. Hump it
you
as far
it,
as you can.
You?
You know, I absolutely loved it. You know, I don't know what the Hungarian for don't let it bounce or stand up or away is, but they should have all been shouted in a very short space of time.
And what is amazing as well is that Lloris is very often criticised for his poor kicking. His kicking today was borderline exceptional, because it was not the only time that he took the right decision. He was able to actually actually pass the ball very, very accurately. So, yeah.
I mean, I thought he got a bit too much credit for whoever was COCOM's to say, you think Lloris has seen a 2-on-2 and thought, oh, you know, I'll just go for it. I mean, maybe, but he just kicked it as far as he could.
I remember seeing him doing something similar when Pochettino was, I might have been sitting next to Jonathan, actually, at Wembley, when Tottenham were playing there, and he did something similar, and it resulted in a goal. And afterwards, I remember his celebration was basically, I did it, I showed them. So yeah, I would give him the benefit of the doubt completely. But it's not a tragedy. I mean, France like 4 points, they will qualify, blah, blah, blah. Perhaps Deschamps will have a look again at his team. And I do think that it was not the right team. I think there is...
What would you have done?
I think that Rabiot is bringing absolutely nothing to the table. It depends. He can be excellent on some occasions, but he can also be completely transparent. And that was the case today. The choices that by the way, that Deschamps did when he replaced Rabiot were quite interesting and unexpected, because he brought on Dembélé to create this, extra pressure on the right wing. But I'd much rather see Corentin Tolisso in that role. When he came on the pitch, his passing is so much superior. His vision is so much superior. But the other thing that really puzzles me is the positioning of Antoine Griezmann. I've been trying to think about it. So I'm turning to the great tactical genius and analyst among us. I do not understand where he's playing. He was so far back. So far back. And he was not playing as a 10. He was not playing as an 8. He was playing as an auxiliary left back at times, or left wing back, doing an awful lot of defensive work against Hungary. So... And he can hurt. I mean, we had the proof of it again today. But he is probably the most lethal in front of goal of all the players we've got. And he was literally not playing in the box. It's very strange. But
it's always going to be a lopsided triangle, that three, because of Mbappe wanting to come from the right, Benzema through the middle, to Griezmann. Is he playing central? Is he playing left? Is he playing somewhere in between? And then his interaction with Rabiot, I guess, is the key to that, which worked so well at the World Cup with Matuidi in that role.
Yeah.
When Dembélé came on, that's a more orthodox left-sided player. So Griezmann then does have to drop deeper. But Dembélé was injured, was he? The fact he got taken off?
Yeah. But he was playing on the right as well, Dembélé.
He was playing on the right, and he felt a tightening of the thigh.
And I was just checking where Kingsley Coman was. His partner's having a baby, so he's popped off for the birth and he's going to come back. Because I'd be interested to... I don't know what you think, Philippe, about Coman and what... You know, he's such a fantastic player and is not... I felt like he would be a game changer for them.
You would have expected... If he had been available, you would have expected him to come on instead of Thomas Lemar, for example. That's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Steve says, what is the French for the Graham Taylor line, can we not knock it? And can you ask Philippe to say it?
There is no French. There is no other language in the galaxy.
what about stick it in the mixer? Dans le mixer?
Dans le mixeur. We have one word, which is balance. It's like throw away everything. Like just pump it forward. Balance.
Balance.
Balance, yes.
Yeah, I always enjoy great football teams in injury time when they need a goal, hoofing it.
And they balance it, yes.
Balance. Pravash says, what do you think about the shorts of the Hungarian goalkeeper? From far away, it looks like he's not wearing anything below the T-shirt. Or is it just me? I mean, that's not... no worse look for a man than top, no bottoms. So I very much hope that he was wearing some shorts. I didn't notice he wasn't wearing shorts. but thank you for the question, all the same. Colin Miller wrote a tweet, the journalist, a reminder that the Carpathian Brigade, the Hungarian ultras group dressed in the black tops behind the goal, regularly praised by casual observers for their atmosphere, have a history of racist chanting against black, gypsy and Jewish communities, regularly display the Nazi salute. I think they had a sign, you know, a sort of anti-kneeling sign that they carried into the ground today. Wilson, you know you're hungry.
And homophobic stuff as well, which is particularly relevant in Hungary at the moment. Mm-hmm. Given a couple of years ago, adoption of children by same-sex couples was banned. And then in the last couple of days, what they call the promotion of homosexuality in schools has been banned, which...
That's sort of like Section 28 type thing.
Exactly, right. Exactly that. it's very easy to look at that full stadium and 60,000 or 55,000 at the French Puskás Arena and sort of to be very excited by it, because we're not used to seeing full stadiums, and the atmosphere has been incredible. And the suggestions that it's possible the semi-finals and the final might be moved to Budapest because of issues with VIPs quarantining at Wembley. But I think we have to be very cautious about what that actually means. Yeah, Hungary has the second highest death rate per capita from COVID in the world. Only Peru is ahead of it. Now, it is true that COVID cases there are very low. I think 169 last week, which is obviously things have worked there. But there are still a lot of restrictions in place, just not for football, because he had this stadium built to promote his own image and his own legacy. And he recognises very acutely the power of sport. He very self-consciously harks back to the golden age of Hungarian football. He wants to, I think he recognises he can't resurrect that, but he wants to sort of get Hungary being good again. So back in April the 1st, 2007, he founded the French Puskás Academy in his home village of Fogshoot on what would have been Puskás's 80th birthday, but he died the previous November. At that time, Orbán was not Prime Minister. He was Prime Minister between 1998 and 2002, then he won the election in 2010. He used that as a mandate for making constitutional reforms. He's severely restricted freedom of the press. There's a lot of things, I think, to be very concerned about. One of the parts of his sort of populist programme is to promote the country through sport, not necessarily just through playing it, but also through hosting events. So they've hosted the World Judo Championships, the World Aquatics Championships, the World Wrestling Championships. The UEFA Super Cup, when they're looking for a host, having had to move it from Portugal, Budapest hosts it. You had the games in the Champions League, the two Anglo-German clashes in the last 16, so Liverpool, Leipzig and City, Dortmund, were all four legs of that were in Budapest. Yeah, he wants people to see Budapest as this sporting host. And so having the rebuilt French Puskás Arena, and it's one of, I think, 25 stadiums that have been built over the last decade, essentially using enormous tax breaks that the government's given anybody who invests in sporting clubs, using that for this tournament and having it full is part of his programme. So, look, it looks great. It's great for Hungarian football. But before we praise it and before we sort of suggest, oh, look, he's conquered COVID, isn't he brilliant? Let's have a think about who he is and why he's doing it and what the actual truth of COVID there is.
It's amazing how authoritarian regimes love to host sporting events and how sporting organisations love to give sporting events to authoritarian regimes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to sound flippant when I say this, but building stadiums, putting an event on, is difficult. And it's really, really difficult when you have to consult with everybody. If you just have somebody at the top going, do this, do that, do this,
yep,
it's really easy. That's why China's good at it. It's why Russia's good at it. It's why Hungary's good at it.
I suppose, as you know, not for balance, that's the wrong phrase, but I think it's okay. You know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't support Hungary, because there are lots of Hungarians.
No, of course not. Of course not.
You know,
and it should also be said that Budapest itself, Fidesz, is Orbán's party, and the mayor of Budapest is the one of the principal anti-Fidesz figures. Just last week, there was a plan to host a campus of the University of Shanghai in Budapest. Protests were organised, which is very complicated because you can only have 500 people at a protest at the moment. So you can have 55,000 at a football stadium, but 500 at a protest, which, again, tells you something about Orbán's priorities. But they arranged for a lot of these protests of 500 to meet in Kossuth Square in front of the parliament. And after that protest, backed by the mayor, this investment in the campus of Shanghai University has at least been delayed until after next year's elections. And in those elections, the polling actually looks pretty bad for Orbán. I mean, when I say pretty bad, it looks close, which has not been the case for a while. So there's real pressure on him to pull off the Euros successfully. And were Hungary to get through, that would be perfect for Orbán. But were they to host the final, that would also be perfect for Orbán. So I don't know to what extent UEFA can consider that when there's so many logistical problems about the semis and the final. But if they do give it to Budapest, it is making quite a statement about what they're prepared to tolerate from the people putting these tournaments on.
Thank you, Wilson. Fascinating stuff. And that'll do for part two. In part three, Sid Lowe joins us for Spain 1, Poland 1. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Joining us, Sid Lowe from Seville. How are you doing, Sid?
I'm all right, thanks, Max. How are you?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks very much. Full-time whistle just gone. Spain 1, Poland 1. What's your reaction?
Well, my reaction, I suppose, is probably less important than the reaction of the two teams, but that helps to kind of paint the picture for you. At the final whistle, the Poland players, and indeed, by the way, the Polish journalists around me, were very, very pleased indeed. They went towards the fans on the other side of the ground from where I am now, and they kind of celebrated, I think obviously because they were in a position where they were basically out. They've now very definitely been given a lifeline. From Spain's point of view, it's the opposite. I think there's a feeling yet again that they created sufficient chances to have won this, that they don't have maybe the clarity in some of the chances to create perhaps better chances, but also they create good enough ones to have won the game. And I think the feeling for Spain really is that sense of a, why does this keep happening? Well, you know, what's wrong with this? Even on a night when they got given, I thought, a fairly soft penalty, but you've probably seen more replays of it than me in the stadium, because to be honest, I've only seen one. I thought a fairly soft penalty. Even that didn't go in. And even the fact that Álvaro Morata finally scored, which is a very nice moment, you'll have seen the celebration, didn't, you know, wasn't enough for them to go through, because, of course, Morata did score one, but he also didn't score two, three, or perhaps even four.
The question I have written down is, why aren't Spain better, Sid?
Well, first of all, I guess I hate to do this, but I have to ask you what you mean by better. What is it that you think is missing? Because the mentality in Spain, I think, is that fundamentally they're a pretty good team except in the two areas. Mm-hmm. That they're a little bit vulnerable at the back and they don't take their chances up front. But as a team, in terms of the use of the ball and so on, they're very, very good. I think you can probably look at the players from a names point of view and say, well, they don't have some of the great players they've had before, but I still think they have a pretty good team.
I suppose that's what I mean, is why is Xavi and Iniesta not playing? Why is it not 2010? That's probably what I mean.
I wouldn't say that anyone thinks that it should be that team anymore, but of course it does condition expectation and conditions the sense of, maybe even as well, you know, the sense of how you play. Because of course you have a style which was entrenched by those three successes, but you don't have exactly the same players to play that same style anymore, at least not in quite the same way.
Sid, two questions. The first one, I think many people are asking themselves, certainly here in England, why Adama Traoré, we've yet to see him at all. And the second question is, do you think there's going to be some kind of criticism of Luis Enrique because of the absence of Iago Aspas, and considering how many chances were missed, and that you thought, you know, there are many times you would have thought, well, Iago Aspas would have put that in the net without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, I mean, you say, will there be? There already has been. So I think there that's already there. And I think as well, you know, we saw it in the first game, and obviously we saw it slightly less tonight, but we will see it as well tonight. The background to the criticism of Álvaro Morata, I think there were lots of elements to it. One, I think, was, you know, the if you like, responses to Álvaro Morata personally. I think the fact that he left Real Madrid doesn't help with some Real Madrid supporting Spain fans. I think there are doubts about him as perhaps as a personality, as being seen as someone who misses too many chances generally, and someone who's seen, I think, as a bit vulnerable. Which obviously, by the way, should be a lesson to not whistle him. It should be a lesson to support him. But that's, you know, a whole other story, perhaps, for another day. But underlying it is that. Underlying it is also the absence of Aspas, and until tonight, the absence of Gerard Moreno. Now, of course, Moreno played tonight, albeit on the right-hand side, and I think him and Aspas probably can play that role together. But, yeah, the absence of Aspas is very significant. Specifically on Adama Traoré, I would sort of go with you on that, but it's not really being talked about in Spain. And the reason I would go with you on that is that Adama Traoré, if he's in this team, in theory at least, it's because he's different. He's more quick, he's more direct, he's more athletic. It's a different type of player to try and break things down when it gets difficult. Because I don't think anyone thinks in terms of talent, and you know, this is not a particularly nice thing to say, but I don't think anyone thinks in terms of talent that he's as good as the other players in the squad, in terms of technical ability and so on. But he's there because theoretically he's someone different when it gets tough. Well, I don't know about you, But a game that you end up drawing against Sweden, and a game that you end up drawing against Poland, and in the last 15 minutes when it's a bit frantic, that theoretically is the moment that you introduce him. If he's in the squad, it's for those moments. And so if he doesn't get introduced even in those moments, then you do think, what's he in the squad for? Now, to be honest with you, I think there are plenty of people in Spain who think, what's he in the squad for anyway? But if he's still not going to go on in that scenario, then yeah, that question becomes even more pertinent.
We've had a day-to-day, Sid, of you know, basically people sort of yelling for Gareth Southgate's head and, you know, saying he's completely clueless and this team will never do anything. What's the reaction? Is it the same in Spain with Enrique? I mean, and Spain only have 2 points.
Certainly, I think there is a feeling that there are certain things that they do wrong. But I think when people look at Spain's performances in Spain, they see very specific flaws. So, for example, the missed chances. Of course, it was Morata who got all of the criticism after the first game. The doubts about the performances of Unai Simón, although, of course, tonight he made one brilliant save from Lewandowski, the doubts about the goalkeeping position and all of those kind of things. But I don't think that necessarily translates in this guy's useless, right, in terms of Luis Enrique. What it does do, I do think he's the kind of person that a lot of people quite like to dislike, because he's sort of deliberately provocative at times. I think largely it's tongue-in-cheek. I think largely it's almost funny, but I don't think it's always treated as particularly funny. And also, you know, again, Luis Enrique has a particular type of slightly provocative personality, has his own backstory as someone who left Real Madrid for Barcelona. You know, there are lots of reasons why people are ready to dislike him, but I don't think it's quite got to that point yet of people saying this guy is just rubbish.
Wilson, Poland deserves something from that game, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I thought they were a bit unlucky against Slovakia. I thought they got back into the game, were on top when the red card happened. And we've seen Poland at countless tournaments going into it with high hopes. Something goes wrong and the wheels fall off. And I sort of feel it's always the same problem. They always have these sort of lumbering centre-backs who somehow just don't quite seem to fit modern football. But no, I thought today they played very intelligently on the break. Lewandowski obviously always gives you a chance, but I thought Frankowski played pretty well today as well. So particularly having gone behind, I think you have to give them credit, not just for getting back into the game, but for actually having the character to get back in the game, which I think has not always been the case with Poland squads. You know, if you think back to the World Cup, and they just folded that game into Colombia, which I think was the second group game, and they lost 3-0, which put them out. They didn't do that today, so that's a good thing.
And I don't know what it looked like to you, Sid, but from where I was, it looked like, because often they say Lewandowski just doesn't have any support, and clearly the team are not as good as the team he normally plays in. But it did feel like at times there were players alongside him, there were players supporting him, there were players that he was bringing into the game as well.
Yeah, I mean, apart from that one in the first half when he went running completely on his
yeah,
own.
Yeah, apart from that one.
That was kind of like the embodiment of that idea, wasn't it? It's like, there goes Robert, and everyone goes, have a run, Robert, see what you can do. But the rest of the game, I think that's right. And I think, look, I don't know about you, but I felt like for a lot of the game, obviously Poland started with this, I don't really know whether to call it five at the back. I think it certainly was when they were defending. I felt that every single time, almost every single time, that Poland broke and sort of came from deep and started running at Spain, Spain looked really nervous. I thought Spain looked really, really vulnerable every time Poland went at them. And the key thing to, you know, to directly fit into what you and Jonathan are saying is that that wasn't only Lewandowski breaking to come and be part of it. I mean, forgive me, obviously, by definition, I tend to see it through a kind of Spanish prism. But I was really struck by Spain's vulnerability when Poland broke. And yeah, probably surprised by how quick I thought Poland were, because I imagine that their threat would be much more as it was in the goal, you know, across and the ability in the air. And actually, I think in the goal, I haven't had a chance to see a replay, so you may say I'm wrong. It felt like Lewandowski was sort of managed to shrug off Laporte a little bit too easily.
I was going to ask you, Sid, actually, about Emerick Laporte, because the first two games have been a little bit on the difficult side, haven't they?
They certainly have, and obviously in that first game, that run where Isak kind of went through, paused, stopped, waited a bit, and ended up hitting the post. It was Laporte, I think, that he got away from. And then the one in the second half where he created the chance for Marcus Berg, it was three players he got away from. I must confess, I can't remember which three it was, but given that he was in the area, I think one of them must have been Laporte. It certainly hasn't been from him two performances that make everyone go, well, see, that's why we did it. What a great idea it was to, you know, to bring him in. Look, I don't think that necessarily means that people think he shouldn't start or shouldn't play, obviously beyond all those other questions. And, you know, those other questions have been there about naturalising players. But it hasn't been seen as a disaster, but it certainly hasn't been a roaring success so far.
Wilson, Group E looks quite fun now, doesn't it? Sweden 4 points, Slovakia 3, Spain 2, Poland 1. It could go either way.
Clive. Yeah, I mean, I guess you would want to be in Sweden's position. I mean, they're top of the group, aren't they? So that's a really, really banal
yes,
thing to
yes.
say.
You understand league tables, Wilson. Well
so,
done.
Four is bigger than three, right?
Correct. Yeah. And top of the league is good.
But I don't know. It's such a strange group just because of the dynamic of every game. The fact that, I mean, Spain tonight, I think, had 76% possession, which obviously is a catastrophic fall from the 85.1% they had against Sweden. But both Sweden and Slovakia are teams who desperately want to sit deep. And I don't really know what Poland want to do because I think the sort of the natural instincts of Poland's players.
Are we on a Zoom, Sid?
Sorry, that was the press conference jumping in, but yeah.
Do you need to? Do you need to go?
To be honest, yeah, I sort of
go
do.
For it. Go for it. Cheers, Sid.
See you later. Bye bye.
Take it easy, Sid Lowe there at his press conference, and hopefully we caught the start of it. Carry on, Wilson.
As I was saying before, I was so rudely interrupted by that Spanish man. Paulo Sousa, I think, he pretty much always plays with three at the back. He wants to control possession. And that makes him a very strange appointment for Poland, unless Poland are thinking of completely overhauling how they want to play football. That they are a team who historically have not fared well with three at the back, and I think that was a major concern when he came in. And I think they would instinctively want to play on the break. I think that's how they have played generally for the last 20 years or so, even going back to the Issa Debo side in 2002. So they played successfully on the break tonight. Slovakia, I think, sort of lured them in a bit in that first half of the first game, that they got Poland overcommitting in a way they perhaps didn't want to. Then the second half they had to, and actually looked much better doing that. And although the goal they scored that night, the finish was a bit ropey. The move leading up to it was a really lovely move. It was a classic sort of Paulo Sousa team move. So you'd assume that Poland would try to take a game to Sweden, but I'm not sure that's necessarily the best thing to do.
Cameron says, does Paulo Sousa have a gig with Spandau Ballet tonight? I thought he looked great compared to Luis Enrique, who very much like he'd just come off, a four ball at the Grove.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It wasn't even like a big golf day. It was sort of like, it wasn't his smartest clothes. It was his like second or third smartest golfing clothes.
I think you're right. Yeah, it was just like a charity day that, one of his old teammates was running and he thought he'd go and help out. Clearly not vitally important. Moving on from this game, a note from Lewis, and I don't know if you've seen this, regarding England games and the coverage in the UK. It's if you're not in the UK, BBC have some games, ITV have other games, they're all free to air. Lewis saying, once again, ITV need to take the blame for last night's draw. Since France 98, England's record at tournaments stands at ITV played 24, won 4, drawn 12, lost 8. BBC played 22, won 15, drawn 3, lost 4. I mean, that's quite a huge difference, isn't it? I mean, they get equal pick of the games, right? So how can...
Do they?
Well, I think so.
Well, maybe BBC are just smarter, that they go for the games they think England will win, whereas ITV go for the games they think will get the biggest audience.
So, maybe ITV goes for the games like round of 16 or quarterfinals, which they know England will lose or something like that. Once you go past the group phase.
The last time England won in 90 minutes on ITV, Jude Bellingham was 8 years old.
That was like last week.
That was the Croatia game. Wales are playing tomorrow against Italy. A score update from the Lantwit Major AFC from their social media channel. Apologies for the lack of updates on today's game. This is due to a technical issue, brackets. I'm out on the beers in Rome, and I don't know what the score was. so that's excellent, isn't it? A few emails. You can always get in touch, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Hello to Ashley. Says, hi, Max. Big fan of the show. Been listening for years, but never had any kind of vehicular incident while listening. So not in the inner circle, he says. I'm the UEFA Stadium presenter in Rome for the Euros, but I'm Welsh. Tomorrow will be difficult. I would say, Ashley, go completely biased. You've got a microphone. Turn it on and yell. Razor says, I'm doing 10K a day challenge for the month of June. I usually listen to your pod for my run at some point during the pod, preferably towards the middle or the end. Could you encourage me not to quit, as I'll inevitably be contemplating it? You should have probably finished by now. So, you know, you're either really near the end but quite slow, depending on how much they've edited this, or you're at the start of your next run, or you haven't bothered to listen to this bit. So hopefully you have. And finally, Alex writes, hi, Max, Barry and everyone. I'm writing to you from a lakeside cabin in the middle of a quiet town in the Catskill Mountains, about 3 hours north of New York City. I decided I would try and listen from a large hammock on the property under the shade of two very large trees and quite a distance away from anyone else. Having never sat in a hammock before, how old are you, Alex? I don't frequent hammocks often, but, you know, I don't know how old you are, Alex, but, you know, congratulations on making your hammock debut. Having never sat in a hammock before, it took me some time to figure it out. I managed to get 5 minutes in before Barry started laughing at England's predictably woeful performance against Scotland, which set me off laughing, so much so that I lost balance and span out of the thing onto the ground below. No major injuries, but my wife came running over to find me clambering up while Barry's dulcet tones echoed off the trees around us, and she looked at me in a way that said she knew exactly what happened. Keep up the excellent work. I will try and listen in a deck chair tomorrow. Thank you, Alex. Wherever you are listening, however you are seated or standing or running, thanks for listening to this. We'll be back tomorrow to discuss the culmination of Group A, including Italy, Wales, of course. But for the time being, thanks to Archie and Sid, who couldn't be bothered to be here for the duration. Thank you for putting in all the hard yards, Jonathan Wilson.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Philippe Auclair.
Thank you very much, Max.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.